We interrupt this broadcast to bring you this important bulletin from the United Press. Flash, Washington.
We interrupt our program to bring you a special broadcast. The German news agency...
We interrupt this program to bring you a news bulletin from Washington. The White House has just announced...
Here is a news bulletin. Shots have reportedly been fired.
Here's another late development, and this news keeps coming in.
This is an NBC News hotline report.
Special report. The verdict sparks violence. National alert.
Secret testimony of the miserable souls who survived this terrifying ordeal. The incidents, the places. My friend, we cannot keep this a secret any longer. Can your heart stand the shocking facts of the true story of Joshua P. Warren?
From the land of the sky and to high strangers around the globe, this is Speaking of Strange with Joshua P. Warren.
And the world is becoming more and more insane every day. Welcome to the program that gives you breaking news and insight regarding the paranormal and downright weird. Where the unusual becomes usual, and we don't just discuss it. We go in the field to investigate. Well, have you heard about this one from Staten Island, New York? A mysterious clown has been roaming the streets of Staten Island and freaking out local residents. Staten Islanders have been posting pictures and videos on social media of a person dressed up like a clown wearing a yellow outfit, red shoes, and a mask while holding balloons and waving to the cameras. The clown has been spotted at night near the Richmond Valley and Grassmere train stations and in front of a Chinese restaurant during the day. One guy who took a photo said, quote, "I wish I was joking. It scared the heck out of me. I thought it was like a dummy or cardboard stand-up until he pointed at me," end quote. Others were just as terrified. A number of people said the clown has a smirk on his face, like he's the devil himself, waving down cars, looking weird, using balloons, and laughing. One person said the worst part of it was the fact that he was surrounded by darkness. Not one street light in the area seemed to be working. This was not what you want to see in your headlights in the dark. Who is this guy? Why is he there as part of the real Stephen King's It persona? Nobody knows, but we'll keep tabs on that for you. And let me tell you, there's a lot of other weird stuff happening in the world, especially as we approach April Fool's Day. Thank you for joining us. I'm your host, Joshua P. Warren, author of books like Haunted Asheville, How to Hunt Ghosts, and The Secret Wisdom of Kukulcan. I'm founder and president of Lemur Paranormal Investigations. My producer and engineer is Mr. Hardwood Forrest Connor. Good evening, Forrest.
Good evening, Joshua. You and I are both fighting a cold tonight, I believe.
That's exactly right. You know, in fact, since I last did Speaking of Strange, I have been all over the place. I've been to Dallas, to Denver, to Boise, to Los Angeles, to Washington, D.C. I mean, I've literally been completely across the country from coast to coast, so who knows what all I was exposed to. But I was in Boise to do the George Norrie Live event, which is a stage event where Norrie sets up
some seats on a stage in front of a big, you know, audience in a stadium or an auditorium, and then he interviews guests. He had me, he had Jim Mars, and he had Stan Friedman, and Nori was suffering from a cold. So I'm pretty sure that what I have here is the norovirus, right? Isn't that what it would be called, I think? Which, you know, actually, it's funny because I went for years without getting a cold. And then over the past 4 months, I've had three colds. It's really sucked. And, of course, the fact that Nori has this cold, he was saying the same thing. He hadn't had a cold in years, and now he's got this one. These viruses are becoming more virulent. But do you remember that scene, Forrest, from the documentary Trekkies, where the actor who plays Q...
John Delancey.
Okay, he's in front of a big room full of fans.
I know what you're talking about.
And he has a cold, and he's drinking out of a cup of water, and one of the fans obtains this cup of water and very happily and enthusiastically gulps it down and says, "Woohoo, I've got the Q virus!" Yeah. So I probably have the Nori virus, the little microscopic particles crawling around inside of George Nori are now in me. So I guess I think I've been assimilated by George Nori.
You and George shared something very special, didn't you?
They say that about 90% of your body is bacteria anyway, which is pretty gross. So, yeah, there's some kind of a dark, new, intimate connection, I think, between Nori and myself here. How does that sound to you, Investigator Shelley Wright? Does that make you feel a little tingly inside?
Not at all. Actually, I feel great. I'm not sick.
I
just got the one finger wave from Forrest.
Well, but you're sitting there next to Forrest, and he's got a cold, so... You know, all that could change. You got to be very careful.
Well, I had a cold the last show.
Oh, yeah, is that right? Well, you probably gave Forrest the cold.
I've got the S bug.
So you think that's what it is? Shelley's assimilating you. Nori's assimilating me. See, they're vampiric people. You know, yeah,
there's the red S bug.
Yeah. They're devouring us. But, yeah, the event in Boise was great. By the way, Forrest, have you ever been there?
I've never been to that part of the world.
Well, for one thing, they say the correct pronunciation is Boise.
Boise.
Not Boise like zebra. You pronounce it like an S because it is an S.
It's spelled.
So, yeah, you pronounce it Boise. Boise, Idaho. And... I must tell you, I was really impressed with Boise. It was a wonderful town. It actually has a vibe very much like Asheville. It had a really rampant nightlife. I mean, the streets were full of people, a lot of young people hitting up restaurants and bars, good food, and street vendors everywhere. And the town was extremely clean. Everybody was really, really nice, and very intelligent. And in fact, I got there at night, and so all I could really see the first night I got there was just, you know, the little shops and stores that were illuminated. But I woke up the next morning and looked outside, and wow, the place is ringed with snow-capped mountains. And you just don't think of that sort of thing when you think of Boise, Idaho. You just think of potatoes, really. That's about it. But it was a great little place. It has that same kind of vibe that you get in, like, Asheville, Austin. People talk about that kind of vibe in, like, Portland, Oregon. So it was a very cool place, and I look forward to going back there at some point. The event was a big, big smash success. And I just want to toss this out here, Forrest. I know that this may seem like I'm trying to stroke my ego a little bit, but I'm not. I just wanted to tell you guys that the crowd there was so enthusiastic that afterward, when I was out there doing signings, two women on separate occasions came up to me in tears. They were so overwhelmed to meet me. Can you believe that, Forrest? And one woman actually came up. She saw me. She burst into tears. She knelt before me and grabbed my hand and began kissing it like Mary Magdalene. And I said, "Arise, my child. This is not necessary." And this was such a huge moment. Everybody in the lobby was looking. That's the impact that the Coast folks are having on their fan base. Now, Shelley, you've done that to me a few times.
So that was the dream you had last night.
So you understand.
Mm.
You understand. I think that's how we met each other, isn't it, Shelley? You knelt before me and kissed my hand like the Pope.
No, I think that was you that knelt before me.
But no, really, the fans there were fantastic, man. They, you know, and it's always weird because a lot of times, you know, like Jim Mars was saying, you spend your life in isolation writing books or you know, working on projects, and it's pretty wild when you're able to get out there and let people sort of tell you how much they enjoy your work. So it was a big success, and I'm talking right now with some of the people who put these things together to see if it might be possible to bring one of these to Asheville. How cool would that be, huh?
That would be cool.
Yeah, I think it would be a big hit in Asheville, so we'll see. Also, not only was I able to do the event, but my plane out of there did not leave until the evening of the next day, and so I got an opportunity to visit the Idaho State Penitentiary. A couple of the people there who were involved with the planning, a young lady named Ellen and Will, who is sort of the brains behind this whole thing, they spent the day taking me around and showing me some cool places in Idaho. And the Idaho State Pen is one of these places that really looks like a classic Shawshank Redemption type prison. And we got to take a little break here, but when we come back, I want to tell you one little thing about the Idaho State Pen, because when I toured the place, they took me into the execution chamber, and they usually have the door locked there. It's a place that you can't get into unless you have a guide. And I'll tell you a little bit about what it was like at the execution chamber there. And then, as I mentioned, April 1st is coming up soon, April Fool's Day, and the month of April has always been of interest to us on this program because there is just a long, long list, historically speaking, of things that take place in April that you could either consider bad luck or just weird, weird phenomena. And we're going to talk about that, as well as the real origins of this whole thing regarding the month of April. Why do we have this thing called April Fool's Day? And what does April itself mean? What clues might we be able to get about this odd month? And who knows if we're going to be able to make it through all the weird news we've got for you. That's what we try to do here every Saturday night, though. I'm Joshua P. Warren. It's the program where the unusual becomes usual. Presented to you, my friends, by Wright's Coin Shop. You're listening to Speaking of Strange.
On the 45, while it's
Hitchhiking the ET Highway, I am your host, the Wizard of Weird, Joshua P. Warren, and this is Speaking of Strange, brought to you by Wright's Coin Shop, where your money becomes more money. You can call Wright's Coin Shop right now or tomorrow, anytime, 828-298-5402. That's 828-298-5402. And on tonight's Speaking of Strange, we are going to talk about Weird April and April Fools. And if you don't know about the phenomenon surrounding April, well, you need to just stay tuned because you're going to find this fascinating. And yes, I am broadcasting from Puerto Rico. Forrest and Shelley are in Asheville. So that's why our connection may sound a little bit funny. But I recently got back from a lot of traveling. I went to Boise, Idaho to do the George Norrie Live event. And at one point, I was able to go visit the Idaho State Penitentiary, which was built right after the Civil War. And it's always interesting when you go to these old prisons and they tell you stories about, you know, what incidents have taken place there. For example, the very first guy who escaped from that prison in the 1800s discovered that there was a window somewhere near the administrative kitchen that was arched. And when they ordered the bars for the windows, all of the bars were the same size. And because this window had an arch, there was a 6-inch gap at the top. And this guy was literally able to squirm through a 6-inch gap and escape and was never seen again. You know, nobody knows what happened to him. He successfully escaped. But they used to hang people at this prison. And, in fact, they took us into one cell block that had several stories of cells. I mean, you look back, and it was very, very tall, this building that we were in, and at the top were rafters. And they said that, I believe it was in the 1930s, there was a man who was sentenced to be hanged, and he didn't want to die that way. And so just a few hours before it was time for him to be hanged, he climbed all the way up to the top of the cells and out onto the rafters with all the men down below looking up at him and shouting at him. And the guy just jumps off the top and killed himself, you know, splattered all over the ground right there where we were standing as we heard this story. But the execution room there, the permanent one that they created, was quite an interesting spot because, you know, they used to hang people a lot in Asheville. And that kind of hanging was often done with sort of portable or temporary scaffolding. So they would, it was something they could disassemble and then assemble as needed. And often they would even loan their scaffolding out and it would travel to other places. But they built a permanent gallows at this prison. And again, you don't usually get to go in there, but we took the guided tour, and so the guy takes out this big heavy set of, you know, keys and opens this big thick metal door. And when you walk inside this room, it was really interesting because right in the middle of the floor is a metal trap door with a big metal lever sticking up next to it. And then from the ceiling, you have a large metal piece that has just got a loop on it, basically. And so they would just tie the rope there on the loop and then, you know, put the end of the noose around your neck and, you know, pull the lever and away you go. Yeah. And they said the last guy who was hanged there, I think it was in 1957, he was a fellow who was convicted of murdering a woman in New Jersey. And the guide said that the details of the crime were so horrific he didn't even want to go into them. But the guy was, the condemned man was from New England. And so he had his last meal, which included lobster and strawberry shortcake and whatnot. And then they showed him the rope, which I guess is traditional to make sure it's a good, strong rope to kind of assure people it won't be botched. And then they hung it around his neck, and they threw the trap, and it turns out it was botched. For whatever reason, it did not kill him immediately. However, once you spring the trap door, you're supposed to just do nothing until the guy's dead. And they said that he hanged there and kicked around and choked for over 20 minutes before he finally died. So hopefully that balanced out the lobster and shortcake treat a little bit. But it's pretty wild when you go to places like that where there's so much violence and tragedy that, you know, it's just common. I mean, people would come up to me who knew what I do, and they would say, well, are you picking up anything? You know, do you think this place is haunted? And I'm like, well, yeah. You know, I mean, it's not even like you can discern one thing from another. You go to places where guys are thrown into solitary, where they're put into the hole, into dungeons. They're killing themselves. They're killing each other. They're being executed. I mean, to me, you don't even have to be psychic. I mean, you walk into these places and you can just feel just a cloud, just a mess of frenetic, dark energy everywhere. And you can't even pull one experience out from another. So it was a cool place, though, the kind of place, like, if you're going to shoot a movie about, you know, a prison, you would probably go there, and it was a good set. But when I finally was flying back to Puerto Rico, you've heard me talk about before how that when you go from San Juan over to the West Coast, to the Mayagüez Airport, they put you on a tiny, tiny little airplane. Now, Shelley, when you came to the West Coast, you actually drove.
Right.
So you didn't get to experience the tiny little airplane.
No, I did not.
Yeah, it's pretty much the flying go-kart, you know.
Right.
And it's like sitting in a chair in the sky. And so, I mean, this little Cessna holds, I'm thinking, 8 people. So everybody gets a window seat. And so we were flying from San Juan to Mayagüez. And mind you now, we're right in the middle of the Bermuda Triangle. And it's always a little bit spooky when you're on these tiny little planes. In fact, there was one woman who'd never taken that flight before, and she was downright scared half to death. But we're flying along and looking at these big, beautiful, scenic vistas all around us. And then all of a sudden, outside the windows of the plane was nothing but gray. Boom, just instantly. Visibility gone. Gray. And then the plane starts bumping and dropping up and down dramatically. And, Forrest, you know these documentaries you see about the Bermuda Triangle?
Yes.
That shows a little plane flying along, and all of a sudden there are all these clouds around it, and the compass starts spinning.
Yes, I do. And just as he's describing his story, he drops out. You're listening to Speaking of Strange. We'll try to get Joshua P. Warren back right after this here on News Radio 570 WWNC and on the Internet at www.speakingofstrange.com.
Gotta keep my eyes on the southern sky. Time.
to Speaking of Strange. I'm your host, Joshua P. Warren, here in the Bermuda Triangle. Not surprisingly, if you consider that, we have been having some communication problems. Right when I started talking about the Bermuda Triangle and me flying into this strange cloud and turbulence, boom, connection was gone. But you're there now, aren't you, Forrest?
I hope.
Okay. It's funny because here we are without any visibility on this tiny plane. The plane starts bouncing up and down. My palms started sweating. Okay, even I started becoming a little bit unnerved by this. And, of course, recently, you know, we had the, we got on the news about this Malaysia flight, which, by the way, side note, Jim Mars, Mr. Conspiracy, was asked what he thought about that flight. Now, this was last Saturday, a week ago, before they started claiming that they believed that, you know, they have the wreckage and it was a crash. And he said that he believed that the U.S. government had used its remote control access to take over the airplane and all of its communication systems and guide it to Diego Garcia, which is a base in the middle of the Indian Ocean, operated jointly by the U.S. and the U.K., where they put it in a hangar, questioned all these people on board about the role they were playing in transferring information that was classified and sensitive to China. And then when they were done, they were going to kill every damn body on the plane and claim that it crashed in the ocean. So that's Jim Mars for you. But right after he said that, they started coming out with this whole thing about, well, it's crashed, but we still don't really have a lot of the debris. So anyway, here we are in the middle of the Bermuda Triangle. The plane starts bouncing up and down, and it looks like I'm going into another vortex, another point in space-time. But then, fortunately, it cleared up, and everything was fine again. And it makes you wonder, though, when you have those moments, if, you know, your plane is going to be swallowed up by aliens, or it's going to slip into some other parallel universe. And in thinking about this sort of thing, it reminded me that this new movie called Alien Abduction is going to be out in just a few days. It actually has its world premiere in Morganton, and then it's going to be shown at theaters around the country on April the 4th, I think. And I am actually in this movie. But let me just read you the press release that came out. This was put out by Ed Phillips, a friend who is the head of the Burke County Tourism Development Authority. Headline, Morganton hosts world premiere of sci-fi movie about famous lights. Coming soon to a theater near you, the mysterious Brown Mountain Lights of Burke County. The lights, a natural phenomenon seen for centuries near their namesake mountain, play an integral role in Alien Abduction, a highly anticipated sci-fi thriller hitting the big screens April 4th. The independent movie was filmed in Burke, Avery, and Watauga counties in 2011 and will hold its world premiere Tuesday, April 1st, at the Marquee Cinemas in downtown Morganton. Director Maddie Beckerman and producer Kathy Beckerman, both of Los Angeles, will be on hand for the premiere and will host a Q&A session following the 7 p.m. screening. Beckerman grew up on the East Coast and learned about the Brown Mountain Lights as a kid visiting his grandparents' house in Blowing Rock. During those visits, he also experienced the remoteness of North Carolina's mountains and combined those two ideas into a fictitious story that involves the lights and the disappearance of people. Quote, "We would often get lost on some of the back roads. I remember sitting in the car and daydreaming about what would happen if we really got lost," Beckerman said. "What would happen if our entire family got lost? That was the inspiration. That's where I started," end quote. The movie uses the found footage format to tell the story from the viewpoint of a family on a camping trip to Brown Mountain. Beckerman describes it as a psychological thriller that does not rely on blood and gore to stir emotion. Quote, "Sometimes the things you hear affect you more than the things you see," he said. Burke County Tourism Director Ed Phillips was instrumental in bringing the world premiere to Morganton and feels it will generate renewed interest in the mysterious lights. Quote, "Even though the film is spooky and scary, it will definitely bring attention to the lights. We already have a business in Morganton offering guided tours to try to see the lights," Phillips said. "IFC Films is distributing this worldwide. It's a big deal. I recently read a review that said it's probably the best found footage film since the genre was created by the Blair Witch Project," end quote. The movie also interviews two people most associated with studying the lights, paranormal researcher Joshua Warren of Asheville and scientist Dan Caton of Boone. Oh. Quote,
go ahead.
Okay. Quote, "Making this movie in Burke County and being able to debut the film there is a special moment for me," Beckerman said. "I believe people are going to really react to it. People will see this worldwide, and it will draw attention to the Brown Mountain lights. This will be great for tourism. The movie is fiction, but the lights are there. They're real. Anyone can go see them," end quote. For information on the world premiere, you can go to alienabductionfilm.com or call 888-462-2921. Again, go to alienabductionfilm.com or call 888-462-2921. 2921. So that's the press release. What were you going to say, Forrest?
I just wondered. Well, you know where I'm going.
Yeah, I do.
About certain other professor being interviewed that's an expert on the lights. From my experience with what we've had with Dr. Caton, he does nothing but say the lights don't exist. There's no way these lights can exist. And pretty much. But in recent years, he's come to pretty much ride your coattails with your theory.
Well, you know, Dr. Caton has always come across as a very sort of negative, abrasive figure. And, you know, I think that he believes that he has, you know, some duty to be the doubter in all this. But, the reality is, like you said, Forrest, he started out by saying, there are no lights, there's nothing to it, because I haven't seen it, so it's not real. But he likes attention, and I think that what he has found is that, you know, you get more attention if you start to play along a little bit, like maybe there's something to it. So I don't know what to think about his point of view these days. I definitely know that when we've done our symposiums, a lot of people have been very dissatisfied with his very dismissive tone toward them. So I'm not sure precisely how that, you know, our interviews are going to be integrated into this. But, you know, the way I view the Brown Mountain Lights is that, you know, it is a mystery. I have my ideas on what's happening up there, and a lot of people do, but I don't pretend that I know, and I keep an open mind and a positive outlook, and I would hope that everybody would do that. But it seems like, you know, they always try to stick me and Dan Caton into any story, any coverage of the Brown Mountain Lights, and I don't see him as some kind of a rival, but the media always sort of pits us against each other that way. So, if any of you want to go see this movie, I would be there myself, of course, if I were in Western North Carolina. But Forrest, maybe you or Shelley can go check it out and come back and give us a report, huh?
I'd love to. I mean, have to press. What am I looking for? Put a little pressure on them to maybe do a closed caption movie so Kelly and I could go down there and see it.
Okay. Well, I can put you in touch with the appropriate people just to see if, you know, something can be worked out.
Well, most of the movies now have the closed captions encoded on it. You just have to have a special pair of, like, polarized glasses to see them.
Oh, that's cool. So it's a whole new technology.
Yes.
Yeah, that's pretty wild. We're coming up on another break. When we return, there's a very odd story that I came across here related to you might consider it a haunted object, but it almost seems like it might just be more of a mystical item that has a strange background in Washington State, a very weird place altogether. When we return, I will explain. I'm Joshua P. Warren. You are listening to Speaking of Strange.
Hello, baby. Yeah, this is the Big Bopper speaking. Oh, you sweet man. Do I want? Will I want? Oh, baby, you know what I like. Chantilly lace and a pretty face and a pony tail hanging down. Wiggle in the walk and a giggle in the talk. Make the world go round. Ain't nothing in the world like a big-eyed girl to make me act so funny. Make me spend my money. Make me feel real loose like a long-necked goose, like a girl.
Oh, baby, that's the one I like.
What's that, baby? But, oh, honey. Chantilly lace and a pretty face and a ponytail hanging down. A whistle in the walk and a giggle in the talk. Lord, make the world go round, round, round. There ain't nothing in the world like a big-eyed girl to make me act so funny, make me spend my money, make me feel real loose like a long-necked goose, like a girl. Oh, baby, that's the one I like. What's that, honey? Pick you up at 8. And don't be late. But baby, I ain't got no money, honey. Oh, all right, honey, you know what I like. Chantilly lace and a pretty face.
And we're in the final minutes of hour number one on tonight's Speaking of Strange, presented by Wright's Coin Shop, where your money becomes more money. Write down their number, 828-298-5402. That's 828-298-5402. You can go in there and talk to Miss Shelley Wright and learn all about what you can do to get some money with intrinsic value. Next hour, we're going to talk about this weirdness surrounding the month of April. Why does it start off with April Fool's Day, and why is it historically a bad luck month? But listen to this story. This is from roadtrippers.com. It's a story about Seattle, Washington. The Pacific Northwest is home to some of the world's most enduring mysteries. Sasquatch, D.B. Cooper, and a bottomless pit with supernatural powers. But one of the weirdest unsolved enigmas is that of Seattle's haunted vending machine. It's a strange case that's been mystifying curious locals for at least 15 years, and no one has even come close to cracking it. The antiquated machine sits alone on a sidewalk, wrapped in dents and faded graffiti, and you wouldn't be faulted for thinking it didn't actually work. It's so old and in such a bad state of appearance. But upon clearer inspection, it's clear to see, or closer inspection, it's clear to see, the machine is plugged in, its yellowing backlights still flickering. And what makes this machine so mysterious is its stock. For 75 cents, the machine randomly conjures up a rainbow of bizarre flavors, many of which don't even exist anymore. It sells drinks that are no longer being manufactured. But even stranger than the mystery flavors is where they come from. In almost two decades, no one has ever seen someone stock the machine. In fact, no one even knows who it belongs to, just that it never seems to run out. Quote, I've honestly never seen anyone open it, says Mickey, a locksmith general manager who owns a building near it. Do people get soda out of it frequently? I ask him. Oh, yeah, all the time, all day long, he said. And yet in a decade and a half, you've never seen anyone tampering with it or refilling it. And, of course, he was asked if he's the one who's refilling it, and he says, absolutely not. He says people often gather around the machine to stare at it with almost frightened wonder or put entire rolls of quarters into its bowels in hopes of decoding its mystery button logic. Much like Bigfoot, it appears the secret of Seattle's haunted vending machine isn't going to be solved anytime soon. But for those of us with a few spare quarters and a thirst for mystery, that's not exactly a bad thing. What do you think about that, Forrest?
Weird. I think Mickey might have something to do with it.
Maybe he's using a guerrilla technique to bring some business his way.
But, I mean, the weird thing is like, it's got brands and sodas that have not been, they said, obviously manufactured in years, unless he's just got some kind of big secret stash back there somewhere. But you think those would go bad?
Yeah. Well, you know, they say haunted vending machine. To me, it's more like a magical vending machine.
Right.
And I can see this being like some kind of portal to Narnia. You know, you order up a certain potion, and maybe it's more of an Alice in Wonderland type thing. You know, you hit the button, you get a potion, you drink it, and you're transported to another place. I need something like that in my museum.
That would be neat.
Cool. Yeah. We're coming up on our break, and I guess I'll just tell you briefly, or quickly, there was a massive spill recently that shut down Interstate 220 in Louisiana. It was a semi-truck loaded with corn dogs, and they say the road was covered with about 40,000 of them. Locals were apparently happy to act on the five-second rule, stocking up on the free food for a later date. They say it was a big mess, but a lot of folks are going to be eating pretty good for a while. Everything you needed to make a good corn dog was right there in the middle of the road. Fortunately, no one was injured in the accident. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we will talk about why the month of April has such a mystique. Is it good? Is it bad? Well, it depends on your point of view, but it's definitely strange. I'm Joshua P. Warren. It's the show where the unusual becomes usual, and it is called Speaking of Strange.